Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. If you can't say it, you can't do it.
Welcome to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I'm your host. My name is Franz.
I gotta say, it's really hard for me to do this podcast today. I started reading a book last night, and I would much rather be reading this book than doing this introduction to this podcast, but I want to get something out to you, and I thought I would force myself to do an introduction. I recorded this interview with Bud a couple weeks ago, and I was going to put it up last week, but we talked to Distant Shores last week, and they had that event on Friday, or tomorrow, I guess, that I wanted to help them promote, the Toronto Boat Show. But this book I'm reading is The Martian by Andy Weir, W-E-I-R. Started it last night. I heard it was a good book, but boy, it grabs you and holds you, especially if you're a problem solver. This is about a guy who goes on a mission to Mars and gets left behind by his crew and has to figure a way to survive. And it's a problem-solving book. It's a book of problem-solving, which, if you're a sailor, you're always a problem-solver. So it's a book that grabs you. It's well-written. If you just want to escape, that's a great book for an escape book. Makes you think. Well, this interview today is actually a part of my ASA 104 course. And one of the questions they ask is plan out a menu for a crew of, well, it doesn't define how many there are in the crew, but plan out a menu for a crew for a 5 or 6 day cruise. And I was thinking, this is a stupid question to ask. Come on, this is just pure logic. Until my daughter, and I think I talk about it in my introduction a little bit to the lesson. So my daughter couldn't figure out how to buy food for 5 people when we went out sailing to the Channel Islands off of Ventura when you're on a friend's boat. But I thought it'd be something interesting to share with you. It's a good question, but for the most part, if you're going to be bareboat chartering, you're not going to go 5 days on what's on board. I always keep 5, 10, 20 days of food on my boat, just in case, just in case. I had a friend, Jack. This is back in the 70s. He was sailing in Australia, and his friend, his boat was going to get impounded by the Australian police for some reason or another, and he and Jack went up and jumped on the boat and sailed up to one of the Asian countries just north of Australia. I don't remember which one, but they ran, jumped on the boat, and disappeared, escaping the police. For whatever reason, I don't know what the reason was, and they had a bag of rice, and that was about it. They got very hungry on that trip, so just in case, it's always good to have food on board just in case. Canned food stores a long time. Let me give you a little backstory on Bud. Bud and I met, oh, geez, it was at least 20 years ago. I had called up him trying to get him to be a client of mine. Of course, I manage money, and I saw that he had ran an ad in the Wall Street Journal, and I thought anybody that's running an ad in the Wall Street Journal should be one of my clients. So I called him up. He was selling commercial real estate, and he said, talk to my wife, and I talked to his wife, and we did a little business together. He ended up becoming a client, and I was down in Southern California. He lives down in California. I was down in Southern California visiting some other clients, and I just thought, well, I have never met Bud or his wife, so I thought, why not stop by and meet him? So I called him up, and he said, geez, I'm busy this weekend. Then he said, do you scuba dive? I said, yeah. He said, what are you doing this weekend? I said, I don't have any plans. It was Friday. He said, why don't you get some scuba equipment? hop on a ferry and come out to Twin Harbors in Catalina. I'll meet you there and we'll go scuba diving this weekend. Hey, I'm open for an adventure, so I said, okay. So I did, rented some equipment, caught the ferry out, called Bud when I got out there. He came out and picked me up in a dinghy. It was just him and I, so I don't know who he was going to scuba dive with without me being there, but maybe he was just going to go scuba dive by himself, or maybe I was the excuse for him to head out there himself. Anyway, first dive we went down on, we had this dinghy. We took a dinghy out, and we were scuba diving. We got separated. I ran out of air. The dinghy was anchored to the bottom, and I came up to the surface, and there was a fairly strong current on the surface carrying me away from the dinghy. Of course, we weren't very far offshore, and I don't panic. I just said, well, okay, I can't swim against this current. I'm just going to head to shore. So I started heading to shore, and Bud came up, saw what I was doing, started the dinghy, and came over and picked me up. And that night, we drank too much, partied too much. Next day, we did another scuba diving trip to another spot on the island. And by the end of that weekend, Bud and I were friends, and we've been friends ever since. Sometimes you just click with people. Bud's one of those guys I clicked with. Bud made a bunch of money doing property development for housing tracts in Southern California and then selling these to developers that would actually build the houses. In one of these deals, he bought a big powerboat, 57-foot Tolly craft. Now, Bud and I had been sailing. By the way, Bud is the one that introduced me to my friends that now live in Southern California. Bud was a member of the Balboa Yacht Club, or is a member of the Balboa Yacht Club in Newport Beach, California. And that's the yacht club, as a general rule, that I race out of when I'm sailing in Southern California. Now, I don't race on my boat, but when I'm invited on other people's boats, that's usually the yacht club I'm sailing with, because I know Bud, who's a member there, and I know Craig Reynolds, who's a member there, and Lowry, another friend. All three of these guys came and sailed with me. Bud has been sailing with me in the Mediterranean twice. He sailed with me from Sicily down to Malta 1 year, and then he sailed with me in Greece about 3 years ago. I know he sailed Astapalea, Amagoros, Kosh. Oh, that's right. He got off in Kosh, and I put the boat up. I had another crew coming. We put the boat up at the end that summer. But anyway, he sailed with me a couple times there, and I've sailed with him on his boat. I helped him deliver his 57-foot Tolly craft from Puerto Rico up to as far as the Turks and Caicos. It was planned would bring it all the way to Fort Lauderdale, but we lost an engine in the Turks and Caicos. So his crew abandoned him, and he had to get a professional crew to come and deliver it the rest of the way for him. Sailed with him when he took his boat up the intercoastal waterway. Now, I should say sailing. I mean motorboating, but I go both ways. I'm not a snob. And we went all the way around Manhattan Island 1 year. That was fun. That was fun. Sailing around Manhattan is a fun thing to do. You seem to forget that that is an island. Anyway, Bud and I go way back. He's a friend. I could go on for hours on the things that Bud and I have done over the years. But no point in that. So that's a little backstory on Bud. Got an email from a client this morning. It's from Xavier in Britain, I think. And he says, hi, been listening to your podcast for the last few months. It's very unique and personal, and I've enjoyed it a lot. I'm starting the RYA Daily Skipper and hope to get it before summer with the idea of sailing the summer as crew on boats around the Med or the Atlantic. Thanks for the podcast. Thanks, Xavier. Appreciate the comment. It's always nice to get comments. Then Dan, who I skied with a couple weeks ago, said it's all right to give his last name. His name's Dan Culpepper. He's got a Facebook page up. And I'm going to look through my emails and see if I can find the Facebook page. I told Neil, the man in charge of my social media, to add him as a contact on Facebook, and he has done that. He just replaced 900 pounds of batteries on his boat. He said, if anybody's interested in seeing what he's doing to his boat to prepare for his Atlantic crossing, to go check out his Facebook page. I'll put a link to it in the show notes today. At least I'll give you the name of the Facebook page he has. I mentioned to him that he might look at my other podcast, which is a Series 7 study guide, which helps people studying for the Series 7 exam prepare for it. And he said his wife passed a Series 7 at Merrill Lynch 18 years ago, stayed for a year, then quit. Tough environment for an attractive woman, at least at Merrill in New York City. And I wrote back and said, yeah, it's a tough business for everybody. Not very many people make it in the business. It's a tough business. The odds of succeeding as a broker or financial consultant are very, very slim. But nonetheless, there's a lot of people that try it every year. Okay, the letter says, yes, by all means, read the letter to your flock, and maybe one or two besides you will be interested in the excitement of swapping out 400 pounds of batteries aboard. Pain in the bleep. This is a family-friendly show. Very much looking forward to the sale. His Facebook page is Heddeline, H-E-L-D-E-L-I-N-E, which is a combination of his daughter's first names. So H-E-L-D-E-L-I-N-E. If you want to check out that Facebook page, that's Dan Culpepper. All right, I went snowshoeing yesterday up in the Uintas with my daughter. Went about 3 hours. Beautiful, beautiful. It was 40 degrees. We were down to t-shirts. Actually, I think it was closer to 50 or 60 degrees. The light was reflecting off the snow, and it was warm, warm, warm until you got in the shade, and then it cooled down instantly. We are getting a lot of haze and smog and pollution in Salt Lake Valley, so to get the nice, clean air, you need to go up. We're in an inversion right now. This is the time of year that it's not pleasant to live in Salt Lake Valley when you get these nasty winter inversions. But you get up in the mountains, you get above the inversion, and it's beautiful. That's why I like to ski in the winter. Part of the reason I like to ski in the winter is to get out of this nasty air in the valley. All right, enough of the preamble. Let's get on with my little commercial and then get straight into my interview with Bud. If you're studying for the ASA 101 or 103, I have lessons, audio lessons available at the website. The ASA 101 lessons are also available in iTunes and Amazon, and I'm still trying to get the ASA 103 lessons in there. It takes some time and effort to do that. The ASA 101 lessons are around 7 hours long, and the ASA 103 lessons are about 9 hours long. Audio material, maybe just help you prepare while you're driving or exercising, and it may help you supplement the book learning you're doing to prepare for the written portion of these examinations. I've had a few sales of them. I appreciate everybody that's supported the podcast by buying the audio lessons. And with that out of the way, let's get on to today's episode. I'm going to skip over the rules of the road again this week because I want to get right into it. And it just takes more editing and more time to put that out when I have to drop those rules of the road questions. And it just all takes time. People say, oh, I ought to start a podcast. I say, yeah, go right ahead. It takes a lot longer than you think it does to put out a podcast. So anyway, here we go. This is Sailing Learn to Sail. Audio lessons for Bareboat Cruising Standard Examination Number 104, the ASA Examination Number 104. And this is lesson number 2. In this lesson, we're going to discuss the question, plan a menu and create a provisioning list for a one-week cruise. This is pretty basic, really basic. And why they're saying do it for a one-week cruise, I don't understand. Because the chances are you're never going to be out for 1 week. You're going to be going from port to port, restaurant to restaurant, bar to bar. But be that as it may, let's just discuss what you might do. I've got two parts to this lesson. The part I'm going to be talking about, and then the part that my friend Bud Elam discusses when he prepares a menu for a racing crew, and he's done many races from Southern California to Hawaii and also down to various ports in Mexico. And he's preparing menus for a racing crew of 8, and he discusses what he does
for those races. But let me talk about my experience. I've always said it's not the size of the boat. It's not how many people a boat will sleep. It's how many people a boat will feed. So you really are limited to your crew by the length of your cruise and the number of people on board. I had to do a menu for 30-day crossing of the Atlantic. We did have a stop in the Azores, but we knew there was marginal provisioning available in the Azores. So we just basically packed the boat up for a full one-month cruise. Now, we couldn't do what Bud did in his discussion. So we bought cans and cans and cans of various meats, vegetables. We did not run the refrigerator. So we had to basically pack as if we had no refrigeration. We had a cured ham on board. We had a lot of flour, sugar, rice, beans, basic staples, things that were nutritious and would pack well. And we did not really make a menu. We pretty much just went and bought things we knew we would eat and would store well, canned goods in particular. And the other caveat was, did not need refrigeration. Now, it was not hot, so things didn't spoil quickly. So you could store things for quite a while. Let's talk about some of the staples that are very, very standard on a boat. Eggs. If you can buy eggs that have not been refrigerated, simply turning an egg carton over every day or so will preserve those eggs for at least a month. They may deteriorate slightly, but they're still fine to eat. So eggs do not require refrigeration. Cheeses. Most cheeses don't require that much refrigeration. And if you do start getting some mold on them, just cut off the mold and continue eating it. If you take cheese, cut it up in chunks, and put it in oil, and I'd probably prefer olive oil because it adds a little bit of flavor, you can store cheese indefinitely at room temperature. At least that's been my experience. Cured meats, truly cured meats, such as dried fish, dried salmon, and these are the truly cured meats, not the ones that are in the refrigerator department of your stores. These are the truly cured meats. Those will store indefinitely as well. All through Southeast Asia, you'll find dried fish out for sale. Dried fish will store on a boat just as well as it will on land. Trouble is, when you use dried fish, you need to soak it to get the salt off, because a lot of the curing that is used in dried meats is salt, and fish in particular. So you have to soak it to get the salt off. The first soaking can be done in salt water until you saturate the salt water. Second soaking should be done in fresh water to get that residual salt out. We didn't use the ham. I didn't like the taste of the cured ham, so we ended up throwing that away. We did catch some fish along the way, and we'll talk about that briefly when I have my interview with Bud. But for the most part, we made a lot of bread on board. We had one crew member that would get up in his watch, and his watch was, I think, midnight to 3 a.m. He would get up and he would make bread. He enjoyed doing it. It gave him something to do on his watch. And when we were on watch, we would poke our head up about once every 10 minutes and make sure there was nothing around us, and then go back down below. We were out in the middle of the Atlantic. There was not a lot of shipping where we were at. And it was clear night, so you could see 10, 15, 20 miles. And I always considered a good scan around the horizon every 10 minutes in those conditions was more than adequate. When I would spot a boat, it would usually be so far away that I'd be sitting up in the cockpit for an hour or two before it would get close enough that I could make contact with that boat. And I would usually call the boat on the radio and have a little talk with the person. So planning a menu is pretty straightforward. When I sail in the Mediterranean, I've had it both where my refrigeration has been working and my refrigeration has not been working. It's much nicer to have a working refrigerator. But what I find I put in the refrigerator more than anything else is just beverages. A cold beer is wonderful. A warm beer is not particularly good. So I find I use refrigeration for meats, fresh meats, and beverages, beer, wine, soda pop, water. That's what I tend to use a refrigeration for.
Now, if you're on a long cruise, you may have some frozen meats you would put down there and anything else. But there's a book I can recommend. It's called The Care and Feeding of the Offshore Crew by Lynn Pardee. Maybe Larry and Lynn Pardee, and that's spelled P-A-R-D-E-Y. It's on my bookshelf. It's one of my standard volumes that I refer to. But just plan a meal for yourself. Multiply it by the number of crew members you've got on board. Make sure you have all the ingredients for that. One time I assigned my daughter and her husband to go food shopping for a 3-day cruise out around the Channel Islands off of Ventura, California. We practically starved. They just didn't take into consideration really how much food you need. There were 5 of us on board on that particular sail, and we ran out of food very quickly. We were going through the boat and looking for anything that had been left over. There were old packages of oatmeal there that we ate. There were old packages of soup that we ate. There were old packages of all sorts of things that we finally found and ate. And I've decided not to delegate that responsibility to my daughter in the future. I will do that myself, or my wife and I will do that. But planning a menu, you can keep it simple. Cereal, Danishes for breakfast, coffee, of course, if you're a coffee drinker, or tea if you're a tea drinker. Lunches, we found it was just easiest to have sandwiches. And suppers would be nice. We'd have a cooked meal for supper, something a little more elaborate. And that's really what you had to plan for, was really the suppers. Because you could easily pack away the lunch meats, the peanut butter, the jelly, the honey, the Danish rolls, the croissants, the bread. Those would be easy to pack away. It's the suppers that we really had to do the planning for. And like I say, I doubt if you're ever really going to have to prepare for one solid week of cruising, unless you're doing a transatlantic or a transoceanic passage, or you're doing a long race with a crew of people. And if you do a long race, take advantage of Bud's suggestions. All right, that's going to finish up this introduction. Now we're going to get on to the interview I did with Bud Elam, and then that'll close up this lesson. The next lesson we're going to be talking about, describe the symptoms and first aid treatments for hypothermia and heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Bud Elam. Bud Elam is a professional chef on racing boats. He's done multiple trans-pack races, and Bud's going to give us some ideas on how he prepares the food on board. So, Bud, go into a little bit of your background, what you've done, and let's just get into the subject.
Well, I spent 2 years in the Navy and traveled about, 30,000, what was it? I was on a ship for about 700 days or something like that. And that was not nearly as much fun as racing sailboats to Hawaii or any other thing I've ever done in sailboats. But somehow I was requested on the Transpac trips to come up with meal plans. And in doing that, we had a minimal meal plan the first time and a major meal time the last time. So it was, you have to have a variety. We're out for 2 weeks. And so there's no restaurants and no stores between here and Hawaii. So you have to plan on having a variety of food, some different flavors every day for breakfast, different flavors for dinner. We just pretty much had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch. There's a crew of 8 on the boat, so that's quite a bit of food to pack with us. The other important thing to do, there's something else that I should have said first. If you're going to be out for a week, you need to have enough water for 2 weeks, because if something happens and you run out of water, you could be in trouble. And you can go a long ways without food, but you can't go a long ways without water. And we, on the trips to Hawaii, we had water makers. And every time something happened to the water maker on the way over, and we ended up just barely getting into Hawaii with no water left. It was pretty amazing. And so, because on a race boat, they don't take very much water with you. You're supposed to make water on the way over there. And so I would suggest if you're out for a week, you should at least have 2 weeks' worth of water and also a manual water maker, even if there's an electric one on the boat. You should have a manual one just in case the electric one breaks.
Are these the reverse osmosis water makers you're talking about?
Right, for like a back, for a backpack. And they don't make a lot of water, but it would be enough to sustain. For, let's say you have six people on the boat. You should probably take two. That would be enough to sustain people out at sea for, you know, if you could get stuck, you could break. See, Franz and I sailed from, we didn't sail, we motorboated from Puerto Rico to Turks and Caicos. And we pulled into a harbor there, and there was a boat that pulled in behind us. They had been in a storm. They came down from Virginia. It was a sailboat. They had a broken, the boom had been ripped off the boat, and so were all the sails. They barely limped into the port to get the boat put back together. They had run out of water and out of food because they were out in the ocean for about 5 days longer than they should have been. And they did not have, they almost died. They did not have a manual water maker, and the whole boat was screwed up. But anyway, they finally got into port, and they lived through it. The two passengers that were on the boat, so they'd never go on a boat again as long as they lived. So anyway, but so on the way to Hawaii, we had some type of eggs every morning for breakfast, whether it was egg burrito, eggs over easy, egg. And because they're, you know, you need your protein. We had toast. We had I think I bought on the 14-day trips, I had probably 9 or 10 different types of sausages that I would mix with the eggs in the morning, or bacon, or something to give the eggs some type of flavor besides eggs. Because after when we finished the trip, I was actually not able to eat a scrambled egg for about 2 years after it. So hopefully, and that was with multiple flavors in the food and the eggs. It was just too much eggs for me. The other thing is, for dinner, I pre-made all of the meals, whether they were stews or turkey and gravy or whatever it was. I pre-made those and vacuum-packed them flat, and then flash-froze them. There's usually two refrigerators on a boat. There's a freezer and a refrigerator. And we would stack dry ice in the bottom of the freezer and put the food on it in layers with more layers of dry ice until it filled up to the top. And we'd take the frozen food out of the freezer part and put the frozen food in the refrigerator part to cool whatever was in the refrigerator down enough so it wouldn't spoil. And that worked very well for 13 days. On the 14th day, we'd actually run out of food. We only had top ramen. That's another great thing to take with these top ramen if you have water. So it's difficult to feed a crew of eight a variety of food without pre-making it. You can't just take rice and beans and things like that. You really need to have a variety of food. The crew is up for 24 hours, 14 days, and you have three people up all the time, so you need to keep the younger people fed very well. We also found that if the crew thinks that you're running out of food, they start hoarding and start eating more than they normally would. If you overfeed them for the first 2 or 3 days, they don't panic. They start conserving what they're eating. That was a pretty amazing thing to find out. So, do you have any other questions, Franz?
No, that's good insight, Bud. When I sailed across the Atlantic, we caught a couple of times tuna and gorged on tuna. And before that, we'd been eating a lot of macaroni, a lot of pasta, a lot of bread, a lot of high-carbohydrate foods. And what I noticed was when we suddenly ate all this protein, this big rush of protein into our system, We were thirsty. We were drinking water like crazy. And what I found afterwards is it takes quite a bit more fresh water to digest protein than it does carbohydrates. But when you're racing and you're using your muscles all the time, you do need your protein. So you need to have probably additional water as a result of that.
Right. We did have quite a bit of water, and we made water. We just ran out of water at the end. We had there were eight people on the boat. We had two 20-gallon water tanks, fresh water tanks. Someone pumped one of the fresh water tanks overboard on purpose to lighten the boat up. And we all, you know, I won't mention the person's name, but anyway, that was a major disaster. That was going to Hawaii, and we raced another time going to Mexico, and the same person pumped both water tanks overboard. And I had taken, I had enough, I bought several types of drinks, you know, Coke, Cola, because that's what the young crew wanted, and other things like that, V8 juice. And we're out of the harbor for about two days, and we found that we had no water. The kid, there was enough water. I guess we had enough bottled water for 2 days, and then the water that we had to drink out of the tanks was gone. We didn't know that for 2 days, and that was just that was a disaster. One of the guys was driving. He was only drinking Coca-Cola. He was driving, and he passed out while he was driving. Almost turned the boat over. Someone had to grab the wheel. The guy literally fell down, almost fell overboard.
What caused him to pass out?
Drinking too much Coke.
Oh, okay.
he was on a sugar rush for the other 2 days, because I had two cases of Coke and the Starbucks drinks and Red Bull and all of that stuff. Just as an additional snack besides the water for the kids or the racers at night. So that was pretty much a disaster. So you have to be very careful about your water supply. Do not go short on water. And even if it weighs more, you're better off living safely than dying out there, you guys.
Okay. So now, Bud, you had a 57-foot Tolly craft, a big powerboat, and you did quite a bit of extensive cruising in that boat. And of course, you had you had a dishwasher on board, you had microwaves, you had stoves, you had ovens, but you still had to go and buy food. So when you and your family were on board and you were going long distances, did you do very many long distances, or did you mostly just do port hops and not have to stock up the food?
A 2 day would be long distance. Otherwise, port hopping. You're going, you know, on the East Coast, you're going up to the ICW. You're basically going from bar to bar. You're out there to have fun. Come on.
And you know,
you're out there to be serious. You're out there to have fun.
Yeah.
Visiting Plymouth, and you're seeing Plymouth Rock and all of that. I think we anchored out maybe 20 days out of 2 years or something like that.
Okay.
Otherwise, you were at a port.
And you and I have both been on Jack's boat going out to the Channel Islands from Ventura many times. And you know, our standard operating procedure is you and I tend to go to Costco, or we get a lot of simple foods that are easy to make. What I've found is when you're on a boat, you don't want to do a big preparation except maybe one and a half meals a day, maybe a decent breakfast. But as a general rule for breakfast, I'd just go with yogurt and cereal, lunch sandwich, and we would always buy a lot of cold cuts and mayonnaise, and then
yeah,
supper.
We'd go to Costco and buy frozen fettuccine or a prepared meal that you could put in the oven, because it was a pretty big boat. I had an oven. Oh, also on our Transpac trips, we had all of those vacuum packed bags, and I had a pressure cooker, and I cooked everything. I warmed everything up in a pressure cooker for dinner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we had a because it didn't use as much fuel, and we would bake the bread. We had bread, you know. We took loaves and loaves and loaves of bread, also. So we heat bread up in the oven, and then I would cook the meat, cook the prepared meals in a pressure cooker, and with eight people, you had to take. The pressure cooker is not that big, so you had to do two batches for dinner and feed four guys and feed the other four guys. So the pressure cooker uses way less fuel if you're on a really long trip and you have a natural gas or propane and you're afraid you're going to go through all of that. A pressure cooker would save you a lot of fuel for heating.
That makes a lot of sense. It's a very efficient way of heating food.
Right, and you didn't have to use fresh water to heat it up. I could use salt water because you have these plastic bags in a pan with water, and the steam is what you the, when it steams it really heats the patches up. So that it didn't. I used salt water in the pressure cooker.
Okay,
it worked just fine.
So you were basically cooking food in a bag then for the most part.
Exactly for the dinners, and I prepared breakfast. But the dinners were already pre-prepared, everything, and we had a substantial amount of food for dinner. That was, That was the big meal that everybody looked forward to. Only we never had any wine or beer because you don't have that on races. But if you're luxury cruising in the Caribbean or something, you need to take wine and beer and have a good time.
Talk to me about some of the menus you chose to pre-prepare. Now, were these? Did you actually go out and put this all together ahead of time and then freeze them? What sort of recipes did you use?
So I made like lamb stew, beef stew, turkey tetrazzini, and chicken marcella, and I would cook noodles and freeze those and put them in a bag also, so it was just like preparing a meal at home, but except instead of serving it, you put it in those vacuum-packed bags and freeze it, and then you cook your favorite meals. And you know, if you only have six people, you only have to cook enough for six people, and they don't need to pig out. They can, you can be pretty conservative with it because they're just grateful to eat at night if you're working all day. And so, but with a crew on the way to Hawaii and Mexico, they're young. There were six young guys and two old guys. The young guys ate twice as much as the old guys, so we had to prepare a lot of food. And that's why I took the pressure cooker. It's like a 12-inch, I think it's 12-inch diameter and 10 inches high, and it was packed full of several bags of food in order to heat it up. We had to do that twice to feed the crew at night.
Okay.
It's just whatever you like at home, cook it, vacuum pack it in those, they've got those, I don't remember what the name of those machines are, that vacuum pack it, they've got those heavy-duty bags. They vacuum it and
mm-hmm.
seal it.
Mm-hmm.
What they call they're food savers,
right?
And those things are phenomenal. They saved it, and it also shrinks it down so there's absolutely no air at all in it. And you freeze it, and it freezes solid. And that's once again that you go back to the dry ice on the bottom, layers of food, more dry ice, more layers of food, more dry ice.
Okay.
If you're going to be out for a while, that's a very important way to preserve your food without using any electricity. The dry ice lasted for 10 of the 14 days when we're going to Hawaii.
So you didn't actually run the refrigerator. You just used the inherent coolness of the dry ice, the freezing of the dry ice, and the cool food. You didn't actually run the refrigerator then.
We didn't run the refrigeration for 10 days, which was really amazing. But the last 3 days, when we still had things that needed to be refrigerated, we would turn. It was basically an air conditioning system for a car is what runs the refrigeration on a boat. And so we ran the engine to charge the batteries. Once a night for about an hour or 2 hours, and at that time we would run the refrigeration unit also, but that was after 10 days. So I think most people don't go out for that long on a sailboat, but if they do, they just have to be prepared with enough water. I think that's the main deal.
I think you're right. Water's the key. You can survive a long time with no food, but you can't survive very long without water.
And you'll lose a lot of weight. On a luxury cruise like you went on, well, it wasn't a luxury cruise, but you can fish on the race boats. You're not allowed to fish. The boats are going too fast. If you caught something and tried to drag it in the boat, it would slow the boat down. So we've never fished, but if you're just on sailboats?
Bareboat charter.
Yes, bareboat charter. You can take fishing poles with you. And you catch fish, but if you can't catch fish, you really do need to freeze everything, and you can't depend on catching fish either. So you have to prepare like you aren't going to catch any fish. And you get a fish on a boat; they're bloody. They cause a big mess. So, anyway.
Okay, great. But when you saw the other boats that are in the races, did they use pretty much the same technique that you used as well? Was that pretty standard for racing boats?
Yes, unless there were the big 80-foot boats that were multi-million-dollar boats, they had much more in the way of they had real refrigeration. They would have a motor that would run the refrigeration separate than the engine. They have something else that would run it. So they were basically a wine and cheese cruises on some of these big boats. And some of the boats that were big also just were just like ours. But the dry ice is very standard if you're on a smaller racing boat. Ours is only 55 feet long. And so, anyway.
Thanks for the advice, bud.
Right. Okay. All right.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Talk to you later. Thanks for calling, friends.
Thanks for listening. If you have comments, I do enjoy getting comments from listeners. It sort of keeps me going. And also, if you have any interviews you'd like to have done, let me know. If you're interested in somebody, me talking to somebody, the nice thing about doing a podcast is people that are in business usually like the free publicity. So if you want to learn more about somebody or something, let me know. I'm going to try to get an interview with Brian Toss. Brian Toss is the guy that wrote the book called The Rigger's Apprentice. And it's a standard book on my boat. I refer to it often. When I have to do a splice, I pull out the book and look at the pictures. Well written, somewhat humorous at times, but a well written book. Recommend that for your standard library if you don't have it. But anyway, I'm trying to get an interview with him. We're sort of in the going back and forth with email stage right now. Also, I'm going to be interviewing some other podcasters that have their own sailing podcasts. So look for that in the future. Again, if you're studying for the ASA 101 or 103, I have some audio lessons to help you prepare for the written examination. They're available at the website, medsailor.com. Also, the ASA 101 is available in iTunes. Search for sailing, exclamation point, learn to sail. Lessons for the ASA 101. Or again, just go to the website. Thanks for listening.